Didn't get finished this morning with what we wanted to talk about regarding Matthew 14, verses 22 through 33. I've never been a real good judge of how long it takes to talk about something. So I wanted to talk about that a little more. Do we need an introduction or a review, or we're all together? It'll be shorter if we're all together. Okay, everybody says we're all together. But yeah, let's start over. Yeah, you make yourself an enemy to everybody. Here's the place I want to start. Jesus doesn't explain to them how he's able to walk on water. I think that's interesting because it would seem to deserve or provoke a question. It would seem to deserve an explanation possibly, but it just doesn't explain how he can walk on water. And his purpose here is not to teach the disciples that they can walk on water. None of them ever did that after this incident, as far as we're told in the Bible anyway. That wasn't the point. And people today who do claim to do miracles don't do real well at this one. Have you ever noticed that? There have been attempts, notable attempts, right here in Missouri, 150, maybe 170 years ago or so, up in North Missouri on the Grand River. There were attempts to walk on water to prove a certain point, and if you miss the plank that you're supposed to be walking on, it didn't work out very well. I could tell you stories about that, but then we wouldn't be back to the shortness of doing without an introduction. Point is, this was not to teach people to walk on water. That wasn't the purpose of this exercise. This was to teach people who can't walk on water that God can. That's the point of it. It teaches that in your extremity, God is there and he will respond to your need. Something wrong, Bill? Okay. All right. In Acts 27, Paul was on a ship. You're about to get to that in the morning adult class. On a ship at sea, and the ship was tossed in a storm. The crew was jettisoning the cargo, junking everything they could to keep the ship afloat. They're all fearing for their lives. They're sure they're going to be destroyed. But an angel stands by Paul in the middle of the night, and Paul is perfectly at peace. And the angel gives him an announcement for the rest. Paul tells everybody, "We're going to lose the ship, but we'll all be saved. Therefore, be of good cheer." And that's the way it worked out. Life can be stormy. It's true that some of us suffer more than others, but it's also true that all suffer to some degree. Our great confidence is that we're never away from the authority, the knowledge, and the protective care of the Savior. He walked on water and showed these guys that beyond just being the King of the Jews, he was the universal King of all things. The multitude wanted to make him king, put a crown upon his head. Why did he slip away to a quiet place instead? There was a method to that. There was a reason for it. This was a very convincing experience because it's built on all the other experiences that they've been having with him. The storm is never so severe. The night is never so black. The boat is never so frail that the Lord is not there if you're in Christ. So we need to know that God walks on the water and that he comes to us in the storm because that takes away our fear. What is there to fear? The Lord is either on the mountain interceding with the Father on our behalf, or he's on the sea walking to us. And either way, we're secure. This is an Old Testament theme from the book of Psalms. Let me just give you a few there to reignite memory about what the book of Psalms says about this. Psalm 5, verse 11. "Let those who put their trust in thee rejoice. Let them ever shout for joy because thou defendest them." Psalm 9, 9. "The Lord also will be a refuge for the oppressed, a refuge in times of trouble." Psalm 18. "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield, the horn of my salvation, and my high tower." Psalm 23, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." Psalm 62, He alone is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Psalm 89, I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. These are just a few samples of what the disciples knew to be the truth about God. Peter himself had known healing in his own family, his wife's mother. They all have experienced the Lord's care for them, every one of these disciples. He has fed them. Now he meets their needs in the midst of this disaster, and he becomes their refuge. And the great lesson here is that with Jesus Christ, we need not fear any storm. The Lord told them in verse 22 of Matthew 14 to go to the other side. Mark and John tell us that he sent them toward Capernaum and Bethsaida, which was a suburb of Capernaum. So they agree in the place that he sent them to. On their way, the wind came up and it was contrary to them. It would have been so easy to say, well, these are extenuating circumstances. It's okay if we just turn around and go with the wind back to where we came from. The Lord will understand that. But instead, they continued to pursue the direction the Lord had told them to go in. So we find them in the midst of a storm, but we also find them in the midst of obedience. When we're obedient to the Lord, no matter how severe the storm, you're just as safe as if you were home in bed. The place of safety and security is the place of obedience. When Jude says, keep yourself in the love of God, he means stay within the sphere where God's love is manifest, and that is the sphere of obedience. And therefore, and therein is God's love poured out on his own. If the Lord said, go to Capernaum, and your bow is pointed toward Capernaum, then that's as safe as you can be. He not only has the desire to protect you, he has the ability to protect you. They knew they took the only boat, but at the end of their extremity, without human resource, when there was no other way, he makes the storm his path to save his own. Now, Matthew, Mark, and John all record Jesus walking on the water, but only Matthew records this particular incident with Peter. Peter said, Lord, if it be thou, bid me come to thee on the water. And the Lord said, come. Come. I don't know what the tone or inflection was, but I feel like I can almost hear it. Come. Just a simple come. This is a picture of God's love. God is love. As wet is to water, so love is to God. As warm is to the sun, so love is to God. As blue is to the sky, so love is to God. His love is unending, his love is unbending, his love is unchanging. And the biblical way that love is demonstrated is to take care of the things that people need. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. He met man at the place of his greatest need. Love is not sentimentality. Love is not whimsy. Love meets needs. Now, I've got to ask the question here. Why did Peter do what he did? Here's a man who spent his entire life on and around the Sea of Galilee, and he's never walked on it before. There is impetuosity in his character, but the man is not stupid. Some people think he was showing off in this. But I think even those of us who are show-offs know there are limitations, don't we? To me, the best explanation for why Peter did what he did here is that he wanted to be where Jesus was. He wanted to be where Jesus was so much that he was willing to climb out of the boat to go to be where he was. But you still wouldn't do what he did unless you believed that Jesus had the power to hold you up as he was being held up. So this is a clear-cut act of affection based on confident faith. I don't think we should chastise Peter here. Don't ever say that he didn't love the Lord or didn't trust the Lord. Peter loved him, and he sensed in the presence of the Lord a tremendous safety. He believed that if the Lord could walk on that stuff, that he could too. He could get to where he was and be safe in an environment that he was greatly in fear of. I like that in Peter. He knew he was to his extremity. He knew he had no resources. I like the fact that all he could think of apparently was getting to Jesus, even though you really couldn't do that. But the Lord said, come, so he's going to go. He was consumed with wanting to get to Jesus. As I see Peter, when Jesus in his ministry was walking down a road, if he'd stop real fast, Peter would run into the back of him. Because Peter was almost like a dog when it came to Jesus. He's right at his heel. He's right there where Jesus is. He was always there. He longed to be where Jesus was. So he tried to get as close to him as he could, even at the time of Jesus' trial later on. They wouldn't let him in, that's why he was on the outside, but he hung around as long as he could. The Lord is trying to build into that man the character that it's going to take to lead and to be a catalyst in the first few years of the church. And that's what he was for the first 12 chapters of the book of Acts. All through Jesus' ministry, Jesus is trying to build that into this man, Peter. Finally, he gets to the last chapter of John's gospel, and the Lord hits Peter between the eyes with that crushing blow question. Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Simon, do you love me? I think there was something in Peter that said, oh man, if it's not clear yet that I love him, I'm going to make sure it's clear from here on out. So that he didn't have to ask that question anymore. Eventually the day came that tradition tells us that Peter was going to be put to death for the faith, and he requested that he not be crucified head up, but head down, because he wasn't worthy to be crucified head up like the Lord. He was a faithful martyr. He learned these lessons well. In Matthew 17, when they came to the Mount of Transfiguration, he felt so blessed to be with Jesus and his close friends, that Peter said, Lord, if you want, I'll make three tents here. And his idea may have been that we can just stay up here indefinitely. I'm where I want to be. I'm where Jesus is. Because that was the pinnacle for him. He loved to be where Jesus was. In John 13, Peter said, Lord, you'll never wash my feet. It's beneath you. And the Lord said, well, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And Peter says, okay, I'll take a bath. I just want to be part with you. He wanted to be with Christ, and that's why he turned out to be the leader that he was. He's the first name in the list of the apostles every time we have a list of the apostles anywhere in the New Testament, four different times. And I think he got out of that boat because he wanted to be with Jesus, and he believed the Lord could help him walk on the water too. And he did help him walk on the water. The Lord said, come. The Lord never invites anybody to do anything that's sinful. The Lord never invites anybody to do anything that's proud or presumptuous. So I don't see any showing off here. I just see a man who wants to be where his Lord is. When the Lord says come, it has all the tender compassion that a loving father has when his little child, who has longed to see the safety and security of the father's arms, calls for her father to embrace her. This reminds me of coming home from 2 or 3 weeks away one time when Amber was a little girl in our old house in Lee Summit. She was sleeping upstairs in the room at the far right-hand end of the hall there. And I got been gone for, I think, 3 weeks. I stepped into the room while she was sleeping just to see her. And she had noticeably, visibly changed during my absence, even though it was only a few weeks. And she woke up and said, you did come home to me. You did come home to me. It's like this. Peter just wanted to be where Jesus was. This is very much the same thing. So Jesus says, come. He knew Peter's faith was not everything it could have been. He knew it had some weaknesses to it. He knew it couldn't withstand the storm any better than the little boat could. But the Lord never rejects frail faith. So he says, come anyway. The Lord takes frail faith and he builds it. The Lord never rejects a weak love. He takes that and he builds it. He takes us where we are and he brings us through trials that increase our capacity to believe God and to love God. And thereby, he increases our capacity to enjoy life and all the things that God provides. He giveth us richly all things to enjoy. Peter walked on the water, but he wasn't just walking to be walking. He was walking to go to Jesus. That's all he had in mind, was to go to Jesus. This was a hard test. Peter was in the boat back in Matthew 8 when Jesus was in the boat and calmed the storm from the boat. So he figures Jesus is in control this time too, but the test turned out to be a little tougher than he thought. Verse 30 says, when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And in our song we say, Peter, Peter, when you are sinking. But we don't want to reprimand him too much. Let's point that finger back at ourselves. His faith got him out of the boat. Who else was getting out of the boat? He wanted to be where Jesus was. He was afraid. And now he gets himself into a situation unlike any other in his whole life. He'd been in a boat in a storm, but he'd never been out of the boat in a storm. I think the point here is that we don't need to be taught what we already know. That's why we didn't have a review. You don't need to be taught what you already know. We need to be taught what we don't know yet. How do you build a man but by putting him in a situation he's never yet experienced? How do you do that? You know, when I was young, I was planning to be an evangelist, but everybody said, well, get yourself a secular education and prepare yourself to do something else other than this evangelistic work, and that way you'll always have something to fall back on. I thought that was good advice. So I went to school to get a teaching degree, and did get a teaching degree, took all the classes that they had in the educational program, which I'm afraid turned out to be relatively worthless as far as being in the classroom was concerned. I could never see any really discernible connection between being in an actual classroom and the education classes that I had had. It was rare to find a connection there. But I took all those classes, and then I did the student teaching. And when it came to the student teaching, there was a bunch of stuff to learn there. I had some good cooperating teachers. This was over at Shawnee Mission South. But eventually, you have to get to the place, after taking the classes and having words from the cooperating teachers, eventually you get to the place where you are sent in to a classroom full of high school students. And you know how merciless they can be. And you're thinking, well, are they going to believe I'm a teacher or not? I'm standing there with my hand about ready to grab the doorknob before I go in. I'm thinking, okay, I got to go in. I know that I have to do this, but I'm just wondering what their reaction is going to be. But is there any other way to learn it? That's the point. You can give me another dollar and a half class, but is that going to put me any further down the line? No, I've got to go in and face those kids. I've got to do my best to convince those kids that I am their teacher for that hour, and hopefully I can sell the idea. There's no way to learn that except just to step through that door and to do it. I don't know of any other way, and I think that's what the Lord is teaching us here. Putting Peter in a situation he's never been before. He's fished on that sea all his life, but he hasn't ever had this experience. Can God sustain you in experiences you've never had before? That's the issue here. Can God sustain you through the death of your children? Job didn't know the answer to that until he experienced it. And then he learned that the answer is yes. God can sustain you through the death of your children. Some of us are in that club of people who have lost children. Charlie and Irma joined that club 25 years before Lynn and I did. And that's how we learn that God can take us through those kinds of experiences. That's how you learn that. I think that's the only way to learn that. I hope if you haven't learned it so far in this world, you don't ever have to learn it, the rest of you. And there are other people here that have lost children as well. But it's a unique experience that Lynn and I had never faced before. Charlie and Irma had never faced it before. To Charlie and Irma, it happened in 1985. I was up in Des Moines at the time, got a phone call that I needed to come right down, and I went out, and Charlie met me in the front yard of their old house on Lee Summit Road. And I remember one thing he said. He said, it happens every day, just not to us. And that was right. I mean, that's Charlie's practicality. It happens every day, just not to us. We felt the same way when it happened to us. It's just one of those things. And you know, one way God helps us to deal with those kinds of situations is that he gave us the church. In the church, we have each other to help us through those things. I remember we eventually did decide to go ahead and have a funeral for our son. And at this visitation before the funeral, I was hugging this long line of people. And after a while, I started to hug people that were wet. And I didn't think too much about it, but I started noticing they're wet. And then Alan Van Dusen came through this line. He said, "Don't hug me, I'm all wet." And he was soaking wet. And I said, "Why? Why are you wet?" And he said, "Well, I was helping with the water." And I thought, well, you know, I've been in there for hours. I didn't know what was going on outside. I thought, is there something wrong with the plumbing or what's going on? But it turned out that there was this long line of people. Doug Weekly told me he thought there were 1,000 people there. And there was this long line of people in the hot July sun that were just standing out there sweating, waiting to get into this chapel. If I'd known there had been that many people there, I would have tried to get a better place for you. But we just never thought about it. Anyway, the church sprang into action. They went and got some water for these people standing in this line. See, that's what the church does. This is the way the church functions, and that's one of the ways that God helps us, is through his church. God responds through his people who are dealing with various issues. The church was just absolutely wonderful during that whole nightmare that we could never wake up from. And it made an enormous difference for us. Well, that's one of the ways that it happens. God can sustain you through anything that occurs. It doesn't really much matter what it is. God will take care of it. And these experiences that we have like that are to a large extent what life turns out to be all about. James says that the testing of your faith produces steadfast endurance. The Lord runs us out as far as our extremities will go. And when our faith comes to an end, he lets us begin to sink, and then we say, "Lord, save me." And when he does, that extends our faith just a little bit further. The Christian life is about learning more and more and more to trust God so we can step out in faith and attempt things which we know ourselves to be inadequate to accomplish. Peter was afraid and he began to sink. There was no way to swim with the clothes that he had on. In the middle of that storm, the waves would be up in your nostrils before you knew it. So he just cries out, "Lord, save me. Save me or I perish. Lord, help me or I die." And immediately, Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him. Just like Abraham was not allowed to kill Isaac, Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him just at the right moment. And he said, "I think gently, O ye of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" My answer would have been, "Are you kidding? This is more than I've ever experienced." But even little faith is not to be scoffed at. If little faith will get you out of a boat and walking on water, that's pretty substantial stuff. When we go through trials and we see that he sustains us, our little faith grows and grows. And in Luke 22, Jesus said to Peter, "Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith fail not." As a Christian, you have the promise that Jesus intercedes for you that your faith not fail. When you begin to question God and Christ, when you begin to question everything you have thought to be true, when you don't know how you're going to handle the extremity, when you've lost perspective in life, it's at that very point that Jesus prays on your behalf and intercedes and comes to your rescue. And if your boat is pointed toward Capernaum and you're following a course of obedience, he is there to rescue you. Did Peter learn his lesson? He sure did. When he wrote 1 and 2 Peter, he reflects this lesson in so many ways. And I thank you, Paul, for reading that first chapter of 1 Peter. In the 6th verse of that chapter, 1 Peter 1, Peter says, "In your salvation you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold trials." Peter knew what he was talking about. But now he sees the ends of things when he's writing part of the Bible. It's okay to be going through these things because the trial of your faith, as though by fire, is more precious than gold that perishes. It's making you to be fully to the praise and the glory of God. Peter can look back and say, all these trials that you're going through, I've been there. And I learned, and you will learn, that it's more precious than gold because it increases your capacity to glorify God. Lazarus died. And Mary and Martha didn't understand why the Lord allowed that to happen. They had sent word that Lazarus was sick. Jesus was elsewhere, and they said, come down because he's sick. And he didn't come. Word came that he was dead, and days went by, and the Jews didn't embalm bodies. They had a tradition that on the fourth day, the hovering spirit of that person just went ahead and left because the deterioration of the body was so that it couldn't recognize the form anymore. On the fourth day, Jesus came, and they said, you're too late. You didn't come. Now, Jesus loved these women. I don't think he wants to put them in distress, but he needs to put them in distress, so he runs them out to the end of their extremity. He ran them out to the limit of their faith, and they were sinking. And he went over to the grave and said, Lazarus, come forth, and Lazarus came out. And the faith of Mary and Martha went from distress to rock solid. And it stayed rock solid. Because after that, they had a greater capacity. So, verse 32, when they came into the boat, the wind stopped. They get into the boat, the wind stops just like that. Just like what? Just like that. And the boat was instantly at the shore. Mark 6:51 says that they were amazed beyond measure and wondered greatly. And here in Matthew, it says that they worshiped him. They knew that passage in Job 26:14, which says, the thunder of his power, who can understand? They knew that he was God Almighty, El Shaddai. And when they saw Jesus Christ demonstrate that same characteristic of El Shaddai, they knew that he was one with God and they worshiped him. So the message to us is to worship him. How can you not worship him? God in human flesh. We are called, as they were, by the clear sight of what he did, to bow the knee and worship, proskuneo, to bow, to kiss the hand toward in worship to him. They did it. Who did it? All that were in the boat, all of them, were overwhelmed with the affirmation that this is the Son of God. This is the Son of God. Paul says in Philippians 2, verse 9, that God hath highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. They knew they were in the presence of him of whom it was said in Job chapter 9, verse 8, that he treads upon the waves of the sea. They had read that in the Old Testament. Now they saw it enacted in New Testament times. This was God, and they worshiped him as such. One of the hallmarks of the cults in our time is that they always have some aberrant view of Jesus Christ. Either he's a created being, or he's something other than the way the New Testament presents him. But we worship him as the Messiah of the prophets, the Son of God who was raised from the dead, as God in the flesh, 100% man, 100% God. We worship him as such. If you're outside of Jesus Christ today and you're not worshiping him, then we all need to be in this same little boat of faith. We all need to worship him as who he claimed to be and who he actually is. So if we can assist you today with either primary obedience, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled brethren, let us know how to help you by coming forward to the front as we stand and sing one more song together that's been announced.